Hello and welcome back to Railway Mania. Mental health is something we as a society are increasingly aware of, and railway workers are no exception. Joining us on the podcast today is Paul Stanford, a railway worker of vast experience who has set up a mental health charity called Headshunt. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, hello, Corwin. Thanks very much for having me.
Can we start by talking about your background in railways?
Yes, yeah. I'm fifth generation railwayman, and I joined when I was 16 in 1984. Spent a life working in railways up until the end of 2021, with everything from ticket offices to being a freight manager. I used to be able to work signal boxes. I was a program director. So a range of tasks, say, fifth generation rail worker. And so I am just railway through and through. It's my life. Or what has been my life. Yeah.
Before we get into specific mental health issues experienced by railway workers, please can you give us an explanation of what Headshunt is and what it aims to do?
Yeah, sure. So Headshunt is a fully voluntary body established by my wife Fiona and myself. Really what it aims to do is, you know, it's for people in the railway family, by the railway family. And we, the two of us, hit upon the idea of having a dedicated railway mental health charity a few years ago. And there's no such charity exists. There isn't still to this day. And so we sort of hit upon the concept of me being able to talk about my experiences on the railway. And ultimately, of course, Fiona's talked about her experiences as a partner of a rail worker. And really the aims of it are to make it more acceptable to talk about mental health in the railway family. And I suppose partly to educate people. So to educate railway workers, give them the confidence to speak up, but also, of course, to educate and support other members of the rail industry. And that's either managers or other staff members. So they can look out for their sort of fellow workers, because I really believe in this sort of concept about railway family. So I think education is the key one. I suppose a part of it linked to the education is giving people permission, also giving people confidence. And I suppose a part of it is when I do the talks that I do, and I've just hit 3,000 rail workers that I've talked to, it is me opening myself up, which I know it takes a little bit of nerve. But actually, I do it consciously to help other people, because if people think, well, actually, we saw somebody stand in front of us, and there were 75 of us. He spoke about, you know, issues that he's, or experience that he's had. And actually, do you know what? I think that makes it easier for me to go and talk to my partner or my manager. So the concept, I suppose, really with Headshunt is lived experience shared with people to educate people, give people the confidence. And I think the other element that we didn't recognise when we first established it, Fiona and I met one of the regional directors for Network Rail. And when we met him and presented to him in the summer of 2022, he said, the other thing you've got is you're able to speak about your lived experience and not just share that, say, with a group of rail workers in the office, but actually could contribute to studies that are happening, you know, where you've got that lived experience and you're able to speak about it, whereas a lot of people aren't. So actually, you know, we get you to contribute to work streams and maybe policies or how to safeguard people in the railway family.
Absolutely. I'm sure we'll talk about some of those later on. And this is quite different because it's an element of support. I think everyone's aware at the moment, especially of the role of unions in supporting rail workers financially and in terms of their job hours and stuff like that. Yes. But it's interesting that you say there's not been a railway mental health charity before.
Yeah.
So it really felt like there was a void waiting to be filled there.
It did. And when we sort of set it up in 2022, okay, so it was in the tail end of COVID. So we did a sort of soft launch, like an e-launch, sort of pushed out briefings and what have you. But we did some work beforehand, talking with people across the rail industry that I knew, you know, and really sort of tested it out with them. He said, well, do you think that this is a real need? You know, my wife and I, we think that there is. And it was a resounding yes from people, you know, at all sorts of level of the railway. So it was my peers within, I was working for Network Rail then, but I talked to friends who were train drivers. Very important to us as Headshunt is to work with the rail unions. Interesting that you mentioned the rail unions. And so I sort of talked with some union representatives. You know, they were, you know, resounding in their response to saying, yes, definitely something is needed. You know, that there are some things that are happening. There are things happening now that didn't happen in the rail industry 10 years ago, like the advent of mental health first aiders. But people in the train drivers union, ASLEF, and TSSA union, which represents sort of clerical workers and managers within the railways, they both have sort of said, yeah, there's absolutely a need for it, and we would like to work with you.
In a past life, I once worked on an interview with a general in the army.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was quite a progressive person anyway. And yes. He was talking a lot about things like alternative fuels and things like that, but also about mental health of soldiers and people working for the armed forces. And he was quite fond of this phrase, mental fitness, because his point of view was that you shouldn't wait for it to break. You shouldn't wait for it to all fall over and try to pick up the pieces. This is something you need to work on all the time. It's like keeping your body fit.
Yes.
And we should look at it in the same way. And I think that for railway workers as well, this might be true.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like the analogy, and I correlate to it, because I suppose having experienced myself things like post-traumatic stress disorder from when I used to get a train crashes, I know now, and I've had some sort of great support from the healthcare world and indeed from my employer, but I know now I constantly find that I work at maintaining good mental health, and it's something that I encourage in others. And so I've got a mix of things that I routinely do, and some of the talks that I give in the railway industry, you know, I mention what those things are to hopefully inspire people. So yeah, there's definitely something whereby you as an individual can maintain good mental health, and sometimes, you know, that's almost something you've got to work at it in the same way that people can maintain or improve their physical health. I truly believe, you know, what you've said about the colleague in the armed forces. I truly believe that's true with mental health, that you've got to sort of work at it.
Mm.
Sometimes it can be sort of quite light touch things. It's not going to be massively onerous. But yeah, just keep working at it to keep yourself fit and well mentally.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, I think when you talk about, I mean, you've mentioned yourself, PTSD and stuff, people will naturally go to the most extreme end of people's experiences and things like that.
Yeah.
Occasions that happen rarely, but when they do, they're quite shocking.
Yes.
But if we can start by talking about some of the issues that are faced by railway workers day to day. So
yes.
It was interesting. Earlier on in the year, I was talking to somebody and they were a freight train driver. And I said, oh, well, what's that like? And he said, it's bloody boring because you're on your own for hours and hours at a time. And you are on edge almost because you're poised, ready to act, like, you know, coiled up like a spring for hours and hours and hours at a time. And is that something that you've spoken to people about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had the benefit of travelling with freight train drivers when I worked in the rail freight business. And I can absolutely get it about the responsibility that they carry, 2,000 tonnes or whatever, pushing behind them. But also the very fact that they can be on their own for, say, 4 or 5 hours. You know, only maybe when they have a personal needs break do they get to speak to somebody. Or, you know, or if they have to then bring that 2,000-tonne freight train to a halt and then speak to somebody in a signal box, that'll be the first time that perhaps, other than that, that they'll be silent.
Yeah, and that might not even be a face-to-face talk. That might
absolutely, just be no, more than likely that'll be at the end of, you know, a ship-to-shore phone or a signal post telephone. So, yeah, absolutely. So that'll introduce pressures for people, or I suppose, you know, you can't allow your mind to wander because you're so focused on controlling the freight train. But I've experienced it where you work a signal box and you're in your own space. Often you can be on your own in a signal box. And again, there are things to concentrate on with routing of trains, but then there's times when little happens, but you've still got to be alert, but invariably your mind can sort of move on to other things. So yes, yeah, so the challenges that can face railway staff don't have to be big events. They're just things that happen, or just the monotony of what goes on. And sometimes, of course, it can be a combination of things. Might not even be work things that can just then affect how somebody is when they come to work on the railway each day.
And I think that people can often unwittingly or unwillingly take these things home with them, especially if you're repeating an action over and over and over again. You can find yourself waking up in the middle of the night and thinking about doing that action because it's so drilled into your head, and you find that you're maybe not resting or that kind of thing, just because, you know, these things keep coming back to you because it's been drilled into you. You must not fail at this specific task.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you think about I suppose, from roles that I know. So I know the role. I've got friends who are train drivers. I've travelled with train drivers. So I can see, you know, the pressure that's on them, I suppose, aside from, you know, so keeping the train to time, driving safely, driving in a way that's environmentally friendly. It's a whole multitude of things that are in play for them to concentrate on, aside then from anything else that might be going on in their life that's outside of railway work. And the same, say, in a signal box or with, say, a track worker, where, again, you know, you could be working on your own, could be working in a group. Also, when you work in a group, that brings in the dynamic of making sure that everybody else is safe and well. And so, yeah, there's a lot in play for people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always, I'm of the view, some people might challenge me, you know, that the railways are a bit unusual. They are a 365-day-a-year operation, some of which involve people working alone, working round the clock. You know, it's not like many other tasks within the UK. Probably things like the armed forces, working in certain heavy industries, there's probably some parallels there. Mm. But a lot of what we experience in working in the UK could be, say, office work or even factory work when you're with lots of people. But the railways, they are a bit different.
Well, I think it parallels also why I love doing this podcast so much, because it's such a broad subject and there are so many roles and things that you can never get to the bottom of all of them. But like you say, it's one big machine made up of lots of smaller parts and everybody doing different kinds of roles and facing different kinds of pressures.
Yes, absolutely.
But sticking with loco crews, then, do you think that doing away with the second man had a big effect on railway workers and loco crews and that kind of thing in terms of being in solitude for so long after that?
I guess it must have. It was quite early in my railway career when the second member of the loco crew in the cab disappeared. So a lot of my friends that I grew up with who are train drivers, they've only ever worked on their own.
Right.
So my father, my grandfather were on the railway. Said sometimes, you know, a second person in the cab could be a double-edged sword.
Right.
But sometimes people actually quite enjoyed the solitude.
Mm.
And sometimes, of course, then you would have somebody else in the cab and could be a distraction. The flip of that would be, actually, you've got another mate in the cab, someone you can bounce things off with, or actually they could sort of say, you take over, you have a turn, let me just...
And someone to watch your back as well, you know,
someone
to, like, prevent you from doing something wrong. And you just know that there is a sort of safety net there.
Absolutely.
To an extent. And then looking at things like, you mentioned track workers, and I mean, what comes up so often in anybody who gets the RAIB reports about stuff so often is the mention of lookouts.
Yes.
And the responsibility that goes with something like a lookout. You know, that feeling about being coiled up and under tension for so long because you know you've got the safety of all your mates in your hands and in your actions.
Now, this is a really good thing to report, is there's reduced reliance on lookouts now, because what Network Rail is trying to do, of course, is move away from people working on a live railway. As you say, there's tremendous pressure on people to get the work done, but also then the pressure, traditionally, you know, people had worked between trains, or sometimes whilst trains are still whizzing to the front of you, to the rear of you, that is a lot of pressure on people.
Yeah.
I used to be a controller of site safety. I think it used to be called person in charge of work, PICAL. and so, because I would have lookouts would work for me on site, and, you know, and I, my respect for them was total, by crikey. They had a lot of responsibility, and of course they would be responsible for a whole gang.
Mm.
And so, yeah, as you say, that there's a lot of pressure on people in these roles because they are, you know, although clearly, you know, working on a motorway brings its challenges. If you're a motorway construction worker, you know, and cars, you know, are coned off from you, of course, with a train can't swerve out the way. So it's 120 tons of a locomotive, or more than that if it's a passenger train, 500 tons. Freight train, 2,500 tons, can't swerve out the way. So, yeah, a lot of pressure for people working on the track.
At the other end of the spectrum, we have people, say, more front of house staff.
Mm.
So quite a few of my friends, they work in jobs like dispatchers, for example, and they have to deal with the general public, who are not always in a good mood.
No.
Sometimes they can be lovely.
Yeah.
But sometimes they can also be late for their train. They can become irritable, or they can be intoxicated or anything else like that. What have you seen from talking to people about the challenges faced by front of house staff?
Well, some of the things you've just touched upon, whereby, you know, they've got to keep things calm where naturally people are not particularly reasonable, and sometimes that's understandable, although it doesn't make it acceptable when they're intoxicated. I've seen members of station staff at places like Reading threatened by members of the public, threatened to beat them up because they're so cross about the fact that a train connection went. Now, I'm not sure whether that same person would threaten staff at an airport or an airline. Clearly, because the airline would say, well, that's it. You're not flying. So, yes, staff on station platforms have to contend with a sort of full range of people and people that are clearly at times very upset because their train's late or it might be cancelled. But at the end of the day, you know, underneath that uniform is a human, and they haven't come to work to do a bad job. They've come to do the best they can. And so again, you know, for them, you know, it will be a challenge. Mm. As I say, I've seen it firsthand at places like Reading. I've seen it at sort of local stations on the line from Swindon to Bristol, where staff actually sometimes have to deal with people who are passengers and are suffering a bit mentally, and then they do so incredibly well. And then the extreme of that, again, which it becomes a challenge for the member of station staff, is then dealing with irate passengers who may even threaten them or are intoxicated. So, yeah, so it's the challenges for rail workers come at many different levels and in many different roles.
And what kind of impact could that have on the staff who are dealing with it?
People will take those things home and, you know, and they'll worry about it. Of course, in many cases, they have a rest between the shift and they go back and they have to do it again the next day and the next day and the next day. So, you know, so that can affect people and, you know, it almost doesn't go away. Now, I know that's true for a lot of people working in UK workplaces, that things will still be there the next day. But yeah, people take those things away with them. No, again, you know, where there's an interaction with the public, actually, odds on, it could well happen again the next day. And I suppose it's then how then that affects people, you know, and that they worry about it or it makes them feel down. I suppose then you could put into the mix, if there's anything else going on in their lives outside of any work pressures, then, you know, that individual sort of cup of tolerance, it can sort of overflow.
Is that an analogy that crops up quite a lot in terms of a cup of tolerance? Like, everybody only has so much that, and then you have to empty it every now and again. I think I've heard it before in other places relating to mental health, in that if you are bombarded with too much in one go, it can really overflow.
Yeah.
To keep the analogy.
Yeah. I think it does, you know, and I think back to what you raised 5-10 minutes ago, you know, that about being mentally well and agile and keeping yourself fit mentally helps. But I suppose that there can come a point with people where it's almost just that they're an overload, the tolerance cup is overfilled, and it's almost just like, I'm not going into work today. I feel so stressed, or actually this is eating away at me.
Mm-hmm.
It is only a job. And of course, the railway relies on people being well. So it can be at that point that people sort of say, I've got to step away from this. It's making me ill.
You've touched on this briefly, but I was also thinking about jobs like, for example, signalers.
Yes.
And the long shifts that they put in.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about being in complete solitude in a lonely signal box in the middle of nowhere. But even in the bigger panel boxes that we have now, I mean, they're putting in, I mean, I worked in the media industry for 14 years. So, I mean, I've done the odd long day, but I definitely wouldn't do it every day. You know, I don't think I could face doing that. I struggle to adapt my mind to the idea that you're going to be sort of on duty for that amount of time in one go.
Yeah.
Is that something you've spoken to people about before? The long shifts and the relentlessness of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the shifts can vary in length. An 8-hour shift roster is not uncommon in signal boxes. But similarly, you know, up to 12 hours. That is a long haul.
Yeah.
And okay, people get a meal break in the more modern, large operational centres. So screen-based, because they're large operational centres, large operational areas of control, so a lot to watch and volume of trains. And, you know, I suppose the other thing that sort of comes into the mix, and I think back to some of my relatives on the railway, when I think about this and sort of mental health and well-being on the railways, maybe in the 1970s, the volume of trains running now, and COVID did something slightly odd to it, but you know, the volume of trains running now is as high as it was in the First World War. And 1994 was the sort of low point in the volume of freight running by rail. 1995 was the turning point with passenger numbers where they started going up, having gradually been going down and down and down all the way through the 1960s. 1995 was the turning point. And of course, you know, how does that manifest itself? Let's say for somebody in Thames Valley Signalling Centre at Didcot, it is now the December 2019 timetable change. You know, that was the biggest ever timetable change in 40 years. And you know, literally, you've got trains on the Bristol-London corridor, well, in excess of every 15 minutes. And then you put into the mix then local passenger trains, freight trains. That makes it a very intense role for people to do.
I guess traffic density as well, because it's a reduced network compared to the First World War. So your actual trains occupying any single length of line might be much higher.
Yeah, there's 40% less network now, you know, really sort of since the beaching age, than there was in the 1960s. If I give you some numbers, you know, to contextualise it about, the work life pressures on railway people. You know, in 1994, when rail privatisation started 30 years ago, there were 16,000 trains a day ran, and now there's 24,000.
Goodness me.
So, you know, and of course, things like when the full Elizabeth line service across London started, you know, and of course now there's another push for freight growth. That Network Rail, in the latest business plan, has said they want to drive that by another 7.5% upwards. And the passenger numbers are coming back post-COVID. Actually, it makes for a really busy railway. Mm. And in the mix of all of that, you know, I touched a few minutes ago about doing maintenance work on the track differently to keep people safe. With a very busy network for the number of trains, of course, then you've then got to try and fit in how to maintain the railway, but do it in a way that's safely. So there's a lot of things in play for people that, say, weren't in play 50 years ago, whereby the railway is a busy place to be.
Mm. Yeah, those statistics are staggering. I have no idea. I had heard that a lot of people, obviously there's a lot of talk in the media about our traffic numbers falling since COVID and stuff like that, but I've heard that, no, they're not. It's just people are travelling at different times. Yes. So your average ridership is going up. You just have less focus on peak times.
Yes.
So trains are more consistent now, more consistently loaded.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if we'll just continue to see more of that, which means actually everything will get busier.
Yeah. And certainly pre-COVID, we were seeing that. Post-COVID now, on some routes, they're back up to the pre-COVID level of passengers. Yeah, freight through COVID stayed fairly consistent in terms of the numbers. So now there's going to be another push from Network Rail working with the rail industry to push up the volume of freight. And, you know, and you can see how that wider then plays into to the running of the country about if we're going to meet some of the environmental targets, can't keep relying on road. Mm. So actually, it really depends on people having, I suppose, good levels of mental fortitude and being well and processes in place to help keep people well in what is a busy industry.
Mm. We've touched on a few roles there and what pressures they might face.
Yeah.
But are there any others that come to mind that you want to highlight to people who might not be au fait with how the railways run?
Yeah.
The pressures of the job and what impact that might have on the people doing it.
Yeah, I suppose so we've talked about train drivers. Of course, you know, the same applies to train managers, you know, guards in traditional speak, people in signal boxes, people on maintenance gangs. You know, is the other part of the railway then is the renewal and maintenance of the railway. And okay, so there's the people on the track, on the shovels, who have pressures upon them, but actually the people who are leading and planning that work. And I led a team that formerly had that role, and it was accepted by people, you know, the sort of project managers, team leaders, project engineers. You would work over Christmas, you would work over Easter. That was the norm. Teams that previously worked for me, myself included, 4 Christmases on the trot working. And okay, some of it you can do from home, but actually some of it demands that you're out either in a control office or out on site if there's a bridge lift or whatever. And I suppose then the other grade of staff that we've not talked about, where again, back to what we talk about, busy nature of the railway these days, you know, is staff maintaining trains at depots, mm. which is a 24/7 activity, 365 days of the year. Yeah, so you know, you said yourself, so the railways are so diverse in terms of the tasks that are there and opportunities for people working on their own or working unsociable hours. And, you know, I think you just unwittingly reminded me that published nearly a year ago now, and we as Hedgeshun contributed to it, is there was a study funded by the UK government. They funded the Samaritans. Because it's found that the rail industry is one of the UK industries that has particularly high levels of mental health challenges. And so there was this study undertaken with a series of recommendations that came out. So actually there's a sort of recognition there that I'm not trying to say that the railways are special above all other areas. Absolutely not. But the railways is another part of UK industry where there are a lot of challenges for its workforce that can affect their mental well-being.
Yeah. Something, there's a phrase that you've mentioned, and this came up in a previous episode when we were talking to Dan Fox from Signals to Danger.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He mentioned, especially in regards to the aftermath of the Carmont derailment, mm-hmm. he mentioned the idea of the railway family.
Yes.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, gosh, for me, what does the railway family mean? It really means looking out for people, treating people like you would with family members. And I suppose, you know, so looking out for your mates and actually realizing that, that you're all in this together. You might have slightly different roles. The end output we're all trying to achieve is to run passenger and freight trains each day and keep Britain moving. But yes, so for me, it's very much about, you know, the railway is a family. In some cases, I know I'm a bit of an exception, but successive families have worked in the railway because it's somewhere they want to be. They want to go and work there. Their father might have been there. It's inspired them to go there. But actually, it's much bigger than that, you know, that actually we're all in this together to deliver the timetable or whatever, or to upgrade the railway to allow more trains to run or shinier trains to run or whatever. But actually, you can only do it through really good teamwork and in some cases, of course, talking through things as you would do as a family. So for me, yeah, it means all of those things. But I suppose that the big one really is sort of looking out for people.
Brilliant. Yeah, it did feel like that. I think there was a huge outpouring of support from other railway workers for those who, I mean, this happens anytime there's sort of a tragedy or an accident or an incident because they recognise they're all in it together.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, in practical terms for me, what does that look like? You know, when I would be heading to work in my working life and would see things kick off at a railway station, I would go and help the members of staff on the station. Why would I do it? Because I know they would help me, that they're great people. When things are good, they'd always have me in, have a cup of tea. The same was true then when the chips were down for them. Go and volunteer, and my colleagues would do the same. Go and volunteer. Let's go and give them a hand. You know, there's some perhaps some irate passengers on the platform that just need to be calmed. Let's not see the poor train dispatcher or whatever trying to deal with that. So, you know, again, there's the sort of concept of a sort of family. I think, well, I'll go and help them. They're part of the same family I belong to. Yeah.
The railways have been around for a long time. Yes. I mean, five generations of your family have been able to work in them. So what do you think that the mental health challenges, because, you know, mental health has always been there, but its categorization is quite a modern concept. And what do you think the challenges have been like, what they've changed over the course of the railway's history?
Certainly my recollection, which all goes back 40 years this year, when I started in 1984, sometimes I remember, you know, going to work in new offices and almost in hushed tones. I can actually remember so clearly as I recount to you, people sort of say, so-and-so there suffers a bit with their nerves. And it was almost like in hushed tones that the people were embarrassed to talk about it. Or, you know, it was viewed as a sort of sign of weakness. And so that's something I remember quite clearly from the mid to the late 1980s, certainly through into the early 1990s. And I think now that sort of challenge is going, but still hasn't fully gone. And so because of that, that's one of the reasons behind us wanting to set up EdShunt. Because I think now in the 21st century on sort of UK railways, so people do feel more readily able to talk about things, or there's other support measures like mental health first aiders in place. So that's really good and something that didn't exist even 10 years ago. But of course, with it then, if people feel more able to talk, it's incumbent upon the railways in the broadest sense to then have the mechanism to support those people and the processes to support those people. Whereas probably when I started, things would be hushed up. People, if they went off sick because they were stressed, and back to what we talked about, the cup of tolerance overflowing, I could almost put money on it, wouldn't say, you know, it's because of mental health. They say, I've got a cold. I was off for 2 weeks with flu or whatever.
Because there's a shame associated with
that. Yeah, absolutely. And even as recently as 2018, I presented to the Network Rail chief executive and had that conversation with him. I said, so the team from the personnel side of the business, they've given me all the stats. And we said, we don't think they're true representations. And I talked to our regional personnel manager, and she sort of said, they're not representative of, you know, so some you can cut and pull off data in terms of your number of people off sick and by causation. And I remember Mary saying to me, she said, that's not a true representation, Paul, because people don't want to put truly what causes, or actually they might not feel able to because they don't feel that they would have the support or whatever. But I think things have certainly changed for the better, and people are more able to talk about it now. But I think from what I see, and I still obviously talk with people in the railways when I deliver the well-being talks and lived experience talks, still talk to people. I did one 2 weeks ago at Bristol Parkway, and some people came and talked to me afterwards on a one-on-one, and they sort of said, I am suffering, or my husband is suffering. The rail employer doesn't get it around the pressures that are on me and the support that I need. So there's still more to be done, but things have come a long way, certainly. But to my mind, being challenging of the railway industry, I suppose a challenge to myself and Fiona and the volunteers at Headshunt is actually there's still more that needs doing.
It's something that comes up in discussions about mental health all the time. It's not visible. It's not an injury or something that it's not obvious to other people, and you don't know what someone is dealing with or how they're dealing with it or not dealing with it.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a stigma attached to being signed off sick, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you've been signed off because of stress, and I heard it all the time. People go, oh, just they're malingering.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just want some time off.
Yeah.
And they just want a paid holiday. And what do you think needs to change for people to understand that differently?
Gosh, well, I think it probably means there's still a continuing need for increased education. So, you know, increased education of I'd say the whole workforce, but particularly important it is for sort of leaders of people, team leaders, supervisors, managers, you know, executive leaders, so that people aren't seen as malingerers, that they're offered support or that there's measures taken, you know, in an office or at a signal box or at a train crew depot or a station to support those people. So I think there's certainly more to go out there.
Mm.
You're right that people perceive, you know, if it's the individual and they've taken time off, and I speak from first-hand experience, you know, I was off for 8 months. When I went back, I was actually pleased with myself going back. People were absolutely tremendous. But I took it upon myself, and I would encourage other people to do it, Corwin. Actually, I fired a note out to people. So I said, oh, I'm back at work now, suffered with X, Y, Z, still getting some help. And because I suppose I didn't want people to, you know, I suppose whispers in corridors or whatever, but actually I needn't have feared about that. I think that, I suppose, the step that I learned and I encourage it in other people is say, well, go back, hold your head up high, but do it on your terms, you know. I think people in the rail industry are much more understanding now, and particularly leaders, about things like phased returns to work. So that can help people and make it a bit gentler for them to go back. My personal experience of that was very good.
What gave you the idea or the impetus to do that, to send out that email to explain about it? Where did that come from?
It was partly some sort of thinking I'd sort of solicited myself, you know, pondering, I suppose, and sort of quality thinking time. And something I talked to the GP about. And of course, you know, GP is such a good ally of an individual and the support they can provide. And then sort of something I sort of kicked around with my partner. And I suppose it took a little bit of nerve, but actually the dividends of it sort of paid back, because actually it hasn't got to be awkward for other people, or you can make it less awkward for them. But I suppose a bit of nerve on my part to do it. But I'm glad that I did. It sort of let people know that I was back, the terms on which I was back, you know, so it was a phased return to work. And I suppose, again, in doing it, and what I'm going to say, I suppose, could be unique to me. So I realised that. But in doing it, I sort of thought, well, let me show other people, actually, it's okay to do things like this. Nobody's going to slap you down for doing it. And if it then, I suppose, inspired other people to say, well, you know, was off, but actually I'm going to drop a note out to people now to say I'm back, but on these hours, and I just need a bit of help with X and Y. If it inspired other people, that is a tremendous thing for me, you know.
Did you feel more able to do it because you worked in a position of authority?
Yes, I think it's probably true. But in the same breath, having said that, I'm almost going to undo what I've just said. It is, you know, I felt when I was poorly and in a position of authority, couldn't speak out because it was a sign of weakness.
Is that a carryover from stereotyping now, but the sort of manly men kind of very much aspect so. Of railway
yeah.
workers.
You yeah.
know, the typical thing, you have the bearded Victorian at the head of the steam engine, like driving it with yeah. no cab or anything else, just through all yes. weathers. That kind yeah. of manly man.
Yeah, what a man. Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Do you think that's a carryover of that kind of attitude?
I think it probably is. But it's, I suppose I realised some responsibility on me. But also, I suppose, in my case, and maybe it was linked to my position, I thought, well, actually, if I can help inspire other people, then I'll do it. And if it encourages other people to do it, then I'll do it. Because I suppose that thing about, back to what you asked me earlier about the railway family, I thought, if I can inspire other people, encourage other people to do it, they may be junior to me in the workplace, but if it inspires them, say, well, actually, I feel able to speak up. And I'll drop a note round to people, letting people know I'm back, or you know, do it via a colleague. Then that's something I would feel good about. Yeah, because I say if it helps inspire people and drives a behaviour and sort of gives a permission to other people, then excellent.
It's know? Beneficial to them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We've spoken a bit about the day-to-day challenges faced by the railway family.
Yeah.
But I think we should mention some of the extremes. So
yeah.
we know, for example, because we see it in the news, I mean, talk to any railway worker and they'll mention it.
Yeah.
Things like fatalities.
Yes.
Collisions, incidents,
yes.
that kind of thing. Yep. What's been, without going to gory details,
yep.
but your experience of those kind of events, what they do to people, and what your personal experience of that has been?
I suppose my experience of them is, so I went to several myself as the responsible manager, as the first responder, and didn't think too much about them, almost back to your point about the sort of the macho, you know, the Victorian engine driver in the beard with the cabless engine, thought I was okay. And, you know, sadly, of course, it's not an uncommon thing on the railways. So, of course, you know, the impact sometimes, of course, isn't always felt at that time, you know, and sometimes it can be delayed. There's, in some areas of the rail industry, there's some really good support networks. And of course, you know, people who face having to drive the train and can be the person driving the train when sadly somebody decides to end their life. You know, that's a big impact on them. And there is a good support network there for them. But again, you know, the impacts can sometimes be masked for quite a while before they then come to the fore.
Is that a deliberate masking, or is that the back mind sort of putting it to one side until it brings it up? And
yeah, I don't know. It might even be a bit of both. In the multiple instances that I experienced, I just sort of put it to the back of my mind and sort of, you know, parked it. And my colleagues that I worked with in South Wales, that they were of exactly the same mindset. Some friends of mine are train drivers, you know, and they've driven the train when sadly that's happened on the rail line. Mercifully, with the friends that I know that were driving, you know, they rationalised what happened, realised, of course, that they couldn't steer the train round what was going to happen, and so took a very, not uncaring, but sort of quite a matter-of-fact view. Credit to them, you know, some of them, that happened to them sort of 20 years ago, and they are still fine now, you know, they're good and well now. But of course, it can manifest itself in different ways for different people. For me, what triggered, I suppose, a flashback to those events was making some interceptions with some rail passengers who were in a quite a poor way mentally and were on railway stations looking to sort of take quite a final course of action. And, you know, I was pleased at the time with the two interceptions that I did that it prevented that. But here's the funny thing where the mind is odd. Is it then made those incidents that I experienced in the 1990s come back, I suppose? And that's the thing for people. And I talked to a rail worker at the weekend, and he, much earlier in his life, saw the outcomes of a railway fatality, buried it deep in his mind, and then experienced something 2 years ago with a safety event that wasn't life-threatening, but nevertheless alarmed him. It was a locomotive moving towards him, unplanned. And he sort of said it brought those memories from many, many years ago come back to the fore. In his mind, and I, you know, in my role as a mental health first aider, offered to support him on that. And there are techniques that sort of psychologists can use to help people where they get these intrusive thoughts for maybe something's happened, like a, you know, railway fatality or a train crash or something, to help make, you know, some sort of cognitive behaviour therapy to help lessen the impact of those thoughts.
Mm.
Yeah,
mm.
yeah. So. yeah, it is a real challenge how to sort of deal with those when sadly things like this can happen on the railway. Yeah.
And I mean, it's great that you've been there for those people. Mm, yeah. Are there any instances where people have been experiencing this kind of trauma and they haven't had anyone to turn to that you can think of?
Yes, I can think of a few. I wouldn't want to detail them, and I know you haven't asked me to. But actually, in one of the extreme cases, you know, it then led to that person, you know, taking some very sort of final action. And okay, that was some years ago on the railway, some sort of 10 years ago. So again, with some of the things that I've talked about that's available now. So, you know, I know the train operating companies and Network Rail have free sessions of counselling available to workers. And plus, you've got this network of mental health first aiders, support network. There are a suite of tools available that can help people.
You've mentioned a couple of times about mental health first aiders, but I was wondering if you could just give us an overview of what the role of a mental health first aider is and yes. what they can practically do for people.
Yeah, absolutely. So certainly, well, I'll speak about, I suppose, what I know well. So I trained as a mental health first aider in my last few months on the railway before I took early retirement. And so the Wales and West region of Network Rail, so that's Paddington to Fishguard to Worcester down to Penzance, they've got 200 mental health first aiders. Similarly, the train operating companies, so Transport for Wales Rail, GWR, Crossrail Elizabeth Line, they've all got mental health first aiders. So a mental health first aider, they're formally trained to a laid down criteria, and it's like, so Mental Health England, Mental Health Wales, for the parts of the world that we are, and of course similarly there's a course in Scotland. And so effectively what it does, it teaches people who have put themselves forward as MHFAs, teaches them the signs to look for people that are distressed or might need some help, the measures that they can recommend to people to go and get some help, making themselves available to people so they're approachable to people who may feel they need some help, and you know, say, well, actually, they look up in the office or the train crew depot. Oh yes, you know, Joe Blocks or whatever, it's a mental health first aider. I'll go and talk to them. So they've been through a course, a prescribed course. One of the key teachings of the course, Corwin, is that what they absolutely won't do is insist on a course of recommended action. It's very much the training, and say, having been through the training, and Fiona, my partner's been through the training as well. She's an MHFA. It's very much about how you can suggest things to people and then let people then sort of think, well, actually, I'll do some of that and I'll do some of X, do some of Y. And so it's really about helping them arrive. So being there as, I suppose, an expert, non-judgmental voice, helping point people towards possible solutions to help get themselves better. And then crucially, what I've seen within the rail industry is then the support that exists through the safety organisations within, you know, train operating companies or Network Rail to support the mental health first aiders. Because, of course, there's a risk that they could take on so many cases for people that aren't well in the railway. It could impact them, you know, and have an unintended...
You might feel overwhelmed by it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you think that it requires the person giving the mental health first aid to know the person who's seeking it? Or can this be available to anybody?
So it's certainly available to anybody. I think I've seen cases where people felt comfortable going to mental health first aiders that they knew. Sometimes mental health first aiders had said to the person, look, I think it's probably better if you go to somebody that you don't know, because actually, you know, I know you already. And I think that's where mental health first aiders have worried about being seen as judgmental, notwithstanding any training. So I think, you know, there's probably a few options there for individuals where they can point them, you know, or sometimes... And certainly what I see in Network Rail, this really good network of mental health first aiders, they know what one another's skills are. And sometimes, of course, that then becomes useful, whereby I say, well, actually, talk to Josh or whatever. Josh is experiencing this. Josh is in ex-forces. Because it's funny that there's quite a few ex-forces people in the railways. So again, sort of where they've got a network between one another, where they can help one another, almost comes back to the railway family thing again.
Yeah.
To, you know, make sure you've got the best mental health first aiders to support an individual.
Hmm. Yeah. Great. There is an oddball one here, which
yes.
in my list of questions, and it's something that a friend of mine, when I told her about that I was doing this podcast interview with you, and they yep. said, what about being made the villain? So there's a lot of talk in the media about strikes and things
yes.
like that.
Yeah.
Do you feel that, and I wonder if you've had an experience of railway workers being made to feel like they're the bad people because of the way they're portrayed in the media.
Yeah.
I put a little note in here in that the treatment maybe by employers or by the governing authorities and the people who want to sell newspapers. Things like train drivers are on this much a year, why are they striking? And mistreatment of facts. For example, I heard of a case of where people didn't want to work overtime, and then the employer said, okay, well, you're striking now. That's what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. Is your strike. This is an unplanned strike. And we're going to report it to the papers or whatever that was. I mean, this is hearsay, so it may be through a few filters. Yeah. But that kind of thing, what have you seen from people about how they feel they're portrayed in the media?
I've seen and spoken with people whereby they are concerned that they are vilified. And I've certainly seen it in the newspapers where we've got some quite extreme papers and we can all work out who they are. Where the train drivers are overpaid. That then aggravates travelling members of the public. I've not heard, other than one case that sadly happened a few years ago with somebody who was, during the strikes, there was somebody, I think it was physically abused by a member of the public in connection with the strikes. I've not heard of any specific action. I suppose what's struck me is the newspapers reporting on the strikes the last few years, some newspapers in particular, that will actually stir their readership up, that actually makes it difficult for rail workers. That's plainly wrong. I think for me, the unions can do a good job of articulating what their issues are with the employer. I've seen some real maturity from the train operating companies, where some of the managing directors of the train operating companies would go out on strike days and talk to striking workers because they know that post-strikes, they've still got to maintain a relationship with people. Actually, of course, things like that, of course, won't make the newspaper because that doesn't sell newspapers. Mm. So, yeah, I feel, and it's one of the things that's on the opening page of the Headshunt website, is actually in this sort of industrial unrest of the last couple of years. And I understand why rail workers are unhappy when in some areas they're not seeing pay rises for 5 years. But then I think the way it's been reported is really unhelpful. I've seen it less so on television, but it's some of the newspapers where I've seen it. And actually, and this I suppose is where it hurts me, and it comes back to the railway family thing, you say, well, actually, where people are being vilified, or actually they're almost being lined up by the newspapers to be at the receiving end of some fairly unpleasant behaviour by people on stations who feel aggrieved, and the grievance is understood, that because there's a rail strike on, but it's gone through the legal channels to hold the strike, but they then feel aggrieved as passengers and then take it out on the rail staff. So, yeah, it dismays me to see some poor reporting by the newspapers. And I say there's particular newspapers that delight in doing that. And actually, in doing it, they're affecting somebody who's a real person, under a name badge and a uniform, affecting their mental health. And actually, the greatest asset for the railways is the staff themselves. Mm. That's something I learned when the railway privatisation process kicked off in 1993. My boss said to me, he said, biggest asset for the railways is the staff. So then for those staff to be put in a difficult position, partly caused by the newspapers, that saddens me greatly.
Yeah, I completely agree. Before we move on to talking about Headshunt the charity,
yes,
can you just tell us a bit about your personal experiences as a railway worker in this context?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. By the mid-1990s, I was a frontline manager as an area safety manager initially, and then operations manager responsible for a geographic area with signal boxes and 150 people. But as a part of that, the leadership team, we formed a sort of rapid response, a sort of shift basis. And through undertaking that role, that meant I and my colleagues, we would all sort of cycle around 1 week in three. We would get called out to whatever incidents occurred. And so I attended three rail events where people ended their life on the railways, took charge of about, certainly half a dozen fairly serious train accidents. Actually, none of them involved loss of life, but it was sort of derailments, wagons, generally freight wagons, all over the place, which of course brought with it its own challenges. And so that was my immediate experience. And then later in my railway career, I did these interventions for passengers. Funnily enough, they both happened at Reading Railway Station, one of the busiest stations in the country, one of the few stations that's got a double peak with people coming into Reading and people going out to Reading twice a day. So they were both at Reading Station where I did the interventions. Ironically, when I did those, I wasn't in some sort of on-call production manager role. I was in the role of off-duty railway person, but I just felt that I needed to take a hand and make those interventions. So in a sort of nutshell, that was my experience, that, you know, that sort of combined with, I also saw the London bus bombing, bus exploded in 2005. I think sort of those, put all those things together, are what caused me to have a sort of setback in my sort of mental health and well-being. But they're by no means uncommon for rail workers. You know, we touched on earlier about train drivers and how they're at the sharp end, literally. And aside from controlling freight trains or being responsible for a train with 500 passengers on, they never know quite what can happen. So that was my experience that impacted on my well-being.
And how did it manifest for you? Because you mentioned about when you got signed off work, what was the lead-up to that, and how did that happen for you?
Well, it was interesting how it happened, Corwin. It was in the year of 2020 when COVID really kicked off. My partner, she'd been saying to me for several years, she said, "I think you've got post-traumatic stress disorder." And of course, I was this, in my mind, a bearded engine driver on this cabless engine. And like I was a he-man and could keep going. And I said, "Oh, no, definitely not, definitely not." I found myself realizing in 2020 that generally of the rail suicides that I'd attended and some of the more significant rail crashes that I'd taken charge of, I was getting flashbacks for all of those. The flashbacks would come about every 15 minutes every day. And I can only describe it to people. And when I went and spoke to the doctor, I said, it's almost like a carousel of images go through my mind. And I'd probably been suffering them when I sort of sat down and thought about it and talked to Fiona, my partner, probably after I'd undertaken the second intervention with the distressed rail passenger, which was December 2019. But she thought even in 2020, she thought I'd been perhaps suffering sort of PTSD or something for several years, even prior to that second intervention. So it manifested itself in the form of flashbacks and would make me, the quote from the family would be, "Dad is getting really sparky." So it would make me sort of quite jumpy, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I would get alarmed when I heard sort of loud noises, or if there was a particularly violent film on television, or went to the cinema or something once or twice, I would just walk out of the cinema. Those flashbacks, they were the determiner for me going to the doctors in September 2020. And I suppose the other thing that helped crystallise it is, so at the time I worked for Network Rail, when I woke one morning, and it was on a Saturday morning, and I went to see the GP on the Monday, I sort of challenged myself, Corwin, and sort of thought, there must be something in terms of sort of staff help on the Network Rail, on the intranet, on the staff intranet. And I found a document, and it was called How to Have a Mental Health Conversation with Your Manager. So I filled it in, and then I sort of shared it with Fiona, and I said, "Love, I've got what looks like post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm suffering trauma, but it was sort of stress and anxiety as well, because I kept ticking all these boxes and put the text." So because from that, I went to the GP on the Monday, and she was absolutely fantastic. And she said, you've absolutely got post-traumatic stress disorder, but you've also got, clinical anxiety and depression. But then, armed with that document, I rang my director, and he said, just if you feel up to it, he said, "Come in," and we said, "We'll just go for a cup of tea and a piece of cake, and we'll just sit down and have a talk about you and how we can help you." And so that was the sort of start, I suppose, of getting myself sort of fixed, but also I suppose a sort of a leap of faith of finding this document, filling in the document. That made it so much easier to then frame a conversation with my line manager, made it much more straightforward, not necessarily easy, to have a conversation with the doctor and with Fiona. And so that was the sort of start, I suppose, of putting my hand up, sort of saying, "Oh, excuse me, need some help, please."
You mentioned about the regularity with which these things were happening every 15 minutes. Yeah. Do you think that without the intervention of someone else commenting on your behavior and saying, you're not acting how I remember you acting, or that kind of thing, your behavior is changing.
Yeah.
Do you think you would have noticed it?
Yeah, I think so. In the last few weeks before I filled the document in, I thought, gosh, this is not normal to have flashbacks every 15 minutes. And of course, they were coming at such regularity that it so threw my thought pattern and my, I'm allowed to get away with this pun, through my sort of train of thought.
Very good.
that I sort of thought, gosh, I need to do something about this. And it was the sort of self-recognition, and I sort of got up about 4 o'clock in the morning, I remember it so clearly, I thought, let's go and hunt. There must be a document to give me some, I suppose it's probably validation, but also somewhere where I could sort of set out in a sort of structured way how I was feeling, need to then share with my employer, but also to help frame a conversation with the doctor. So I think probably, aside from any observations from a partner, there was probably a self-realization and probably sort of lesson learned now is, don't leave it so late next time. But actually, sometimes that's easier said than done.
Absolutely.
And it's only when you sort of reconcile it, you might think, gosh, I'm not in a very good place. I need to do sort of something about this. Doing that, and this is where I think of other people, that's quite a hard thing. And I suppose, and so back to earlier what I said in this podcast, is actually if we can create the environment where people feel more readily able to do it, then that's a really good thing.
And had your director that you went and spoke to and you had this chat with, had they had formal training in this?
No. Now, of course, that's changed since, certainly within Network Rail. And I think from conversations I've had with people in train operating companies, there's some work stream in place about, I think, titled something like, how to have a mental health conversation with your manager. So he hadn't. I think where I was fortunate with him is he was a very amiable individual. And I only learned on that day when we sat down together that his partner, she was a consultant psychologist. So I think it probably gave him a level of empathy that wouldn't be ordinary for other people who are leaders in the rail industry.
Yeah, you're quite lucky in that respect.
Yeah, very lucky. Yeah, I realise that.
The steps to recovery then, after you've been able to get this time to recover.
Yes.
What was that like?
It sort of felt sort of quite hard at first, so the steps to recovery initially were some psychology, and some of that was around cognitive behaviour therapy to, I suppose, almost sort of dial down the sort of thinking in my mind, and not go into a sort of tailspin if I was sort of reliving an incident from 20 years earlier. So the psychology lasted for 40 weeks.
Mm.
But in line with that, after about 3 months, I realized I started turning a corner. And I sort of talked to my GP about it, and she was absolutely tremendous. She would have a weekly sort of phone-in session with me to check in with me, and then weekly sessions with a psychologist, and the doctor would speak. And so I sort of had this sort of awareness after about, it would be about 4 months, so it would be January 2021, I wanted to get involved and do some volunteering. I was still signed off from work, and of course, in the end, that was 8 months. And so I started volunteering at a food bank. So it was quite sort of gentle volunteering. One of our sons had volunteered at the food bank, so it was an easy conversation to have. And I sort of reported back to the GP and the psychologist, I felt able to go and do some volunteering because I want to. The GP, she talked to me, she says, we sort of recognise that people sort of start going through almost like a waterfall of sort of positivity, that people can start turning the corner. And sometimes, of course, it can vary so much from person to person. And, from that, I then started thinking by February of that year, could I go back to work? I went in, met my director in March, realised it was a bit too soon. He could see that as well. So in the end, I went back to work on a sort of phased return in May 2021. And at times, I wouldn't have thought that possible. And I suppose that's one of the things I talk about in the sort of the lived experience talks that I do, because for the first 3 months of the psychology, I would start crying whenever I saw a train. It was that bad. So I couldn't, one of my hobbies is model railways and modelling and making stuff. I couldn't do that. I would get really upset if I saw a train go past, and quite difficult when you live in a town when they go over a viaduct over the top of the town.
Yeah.
couldn't pick up a railway book. So all the things that were sort of dear to me, because I thought, you know, railways were in my blood from when I was a small boy, weren't anymore.
I mean, that in itself is to suddenly have such a huge part of your life inaccessible to you.
Yeah.
That is a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
What, during that period, did you have any inkling that it would one day be better?
I think I sort of hoped that it would, but tried not to look too far ahead, to be honest. So just be in the moment, which is quite an important message to, or to all of us, to be honest. So just sort of be in the moment, you know. So I would just do some sketching or read a book, but of course it couldn't be a railway book.
Yep.
You know, I'd always sort of thought, well, I want to go back to work, but I thought, but it, clearly it's not going to happen at the moment. And I did wonder, would I walk away from the railways? But I say, but by end of January, this sort of positivity that was starting to come and things like the sort of psychology were starting to help and dialing down, you know, the frequency of the flashbacks were reduced. And I suppose some of the other teachings from the psychologist around, you know, sort of mindfulness and things like that started having a positive effect, such that by end of January, I actually felt able to go and do a train journey again.
Yeah.
So I'd gone sort of 4 months, no train journey.
Wow. Yeah,
not picking
and from
up.
A life, like you say, living railways.
Yeah.
Day in, day out.
Yeah.
To 4 months, just called to...
Yeah. Hated them.
Yeah.
Would get tearful if I saw an edition of Rail magazine.
Yeah.
Sorry to the editor of Rail magazine. Would get tearful if I saw these things. But that was sort of, I suppose, overcome with some of the psychology, but also about this thing that the GP talked about, almost like sort of like a waterfall of sort of feeling more positive. And as you felt more positive and felt able to do things, doing those things would make you feel positive as well.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do you feel now? Speaking about those experiences, how does it make you feel in comparison to obviously this horrible period that you were going through when you were getting the flashbacks?
Yeah. So through the talks that I put myself forward to do for Headshunt, I will still talk about it. If I'm truthful, will sort of force myself to talk about it because, you know, right back to this thing about the railway family, I want to help other people. And if by me speaking about it, if it inspires other people, then I'll do it. So I gave a talk 2 weeks ago at Bristol Parkway and to 75 railway people. And after I did it, I was like, you know, big sigh, managed to, you know, keep it together and just take my time and speak on the stage in front of all these people. But at the end of it, I would be fibbing if I sort of said it was a joyful experience, but actually I felt good about myself because I thought if I've helped just one person amongst those 75, then fantastic. Actually, if I've helped more than that, and sort of figured in my mind when I did the most recent one, well, actually, if that helps 75 people and they go home and talk to their families, talk to their colleagues, that could maybe be like another 200, 300 people I've helped. So that makes me feel good, but it does make me feel nervous. Generally doesn't make the sort of flashbacks come back. But I think partly the reason for that, or what I've rationalised in my mind, is probably some of the things you asked me about earlier. And when you talked about the military officer analogy, about the things I do to keep myself well. And through keeping myself well, I reconcile with myself. That helps keep my mental robustness there and actually helps look after the cup of tolerance. And so therefore I sort of work out, right, well, I can do some talks. I did in the most extreme, I did 3 talks on 3 consecutive days last September for Network Rail to nearly 300 people.
Bloody hell.
And I said afterwards to Fiona, I said, Lovey, I can't do any more for another month. I said, it'll break me. Yeah. She said, it'll break me as well, having to live with you. So, yeah, so can talk about it, but I know afterwards, I like, you know, and say even, you know, with recording today with you, that's it now. I won't do any of the mental health work this week. You'll be delighted to learn. You know, I'll go and do some railway modelling tomorrow, and I'll get the watercolours out, and we'll knock out another painting or something. Yeah,
brilliant. Can we talk a little bit more about Headshunt specifically? So you've been running it for a while now, but how can Headshunt help people? What are the main ways that you approach helping people?
So I think, you know, so I've sort of touched upon it, you know, about the shared lived experience, if that helps people through either inspiring them to speak up or if it educates people, either people that are suffering themselves or maybe a rail worker looking out for a fellow rail worker, or maybe a supervisor or a manager leading a group of rail workers. I think if it helps educate them and help make conversation happen to help somebody, I think that's one of the key ones for us. That's in the sort of principles document that we've written, because we're going to apply to become a formal charity. So I think that's the big one. If that inspires people to speak up. One of the things that we've done, and it's through one of our volunteers, actually, that works in the Network Rail communications team. And Carla said to me, she said, Paul, said, if we can start keeping a log of when you give the talks about the sort of feedback you get from people. And so, of course, I've done that and sort of run this book. And so sometimes, of course, I get emails or comments on if I do a LinkedIn post. And I spoke on Rail Wellbeing Live in autumn 2022. And the Wellbeing Live team that organised it, they get thousands of people either dialed in live or subsequently could pick up the recordings. And a guy wrote a piece on there, and they cut and pasted the piece and sent it to me. I'll sort of paraphrase it, Colin. He sort of said, Paul Stanford's talk so inspired me and so helped me. The talk should be mandatory for everybody in the railway industry to hear what he has to say and how he tells it, and he tells it with conviction. And he's, but I know there's been other people since then, and it's even the week before last when people came up to me and I was very touched. And it's one of the things that inspires me to keep doing it. You know, if people came and shook my hand and said, gosh, you've given me some ideas how I can get some help for myself, or I can get some help for my husband. So I suppose it's that affirmation from people, or people, because we're a charity, you know, we rely on donations. It's people being inspired to donate money. We had a group of train planners last year at Cross Country Trains at Birmingham. They were inspired to do a charity cake sale for us, raised, you know, hundreds of pounds, and it paid for these. We got these natty little info cards to signpost people about the charity, and so the cake sale paid for that. So we know we have a good effect because of some of the direct quotes from people, or when we get, you know, people bound up to us at the end of the presentation, or whatever, say, boy, you really helped me, or you've given me some ideas, or actually you've given me something to think about.
What wider reach do you think these talks can have? So you have obviously the immediate impact of talking to people and they talk to you afterwards, or what can they take away from it, do you think? And how can that help the extended railway family and their own families?
Yeah, I suppose if with some of the things that we share in the talks, so I talk about them and I make all the material available, but if it equips people with a toolbox of things to do to stay well, or gives them, you know, because of the things that are written within the slide deck, it gives people, I suppose, inspiration. And they think, well, actually, I saw Paul stand in front of 75 of us and he spoke to all of us. He can do that. Actually, I can go and have a conversation with my supervisor. So I suppose if it's of that nature, you know, it inspires people, it gives people permission, it helps educate people, then that's the big thing for us. There are over 200,000 people in the UK rail industry. I'm also including the heritage railway sector in that, which I'd like to do some work with. And the stat generally is about one in four people in this country suffer mental health. And you think, well, over a year, that's 50,000 people. That's a quarter of the workforce not well. That's terrible. So yeah. How can we overcome that?
Yeah.
Now, I know we're a small voluntary body. Most of our volunteers still work on the railways, so their time is limited, but their input is really valued. But I think I've sort of got this number in my mind, so we're at 3,075 people. Hopefully, you know, one of the reasons I was so receptive when you asked, would I do this podcast with you, we can help get to more people. And I suppose both myself and Fiona have sort of realised, actually, this isn't just about the railway industry. So, you know, if it then helps families who have a rail worker in the family, and perhaps the rail worker has heard the talk, and it helps those families. And I know we've had an approach. I've been asked, would I go and speak to the armed forces in June about my experience? And so for me, you know, as soon as I asked the question, I didn't even check the diary. I said, yes, I'll do it. Because actually, I suppose I realise, and it's not just about me. I know it sounds like it's a lot about me. I'm trying to support some of our volunteers. I can get some of our volunteers doing some of the talks as well. And I just need to help support them and get them to that place. Is the sort of realisation, I think, well, gosh, what else can we do as Headshunt? to help people, and it's not got to be limited to railway people.
Mm.
Or actually, because the railways touch, say, over 200,000 people in the UK rail industry, and potentially that could open up, I suppose it could open up to 1 million people with families. You think, well, where could you stop?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, and you also mentioned about how many people in the rail industry are ex-forces.
Yes.
For example, and kind of similar workflows and work demands placed on people in both industries.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think, you know, hence I've been very happy that we work with the Samaritans. This request to go and talk to the armed forces in June, yeah, absolutely go and do it. And I think if I had any other requests or I can see opportunities where we can volunteer ourselves, it doesn't have to be to a railway company. You know, if it's something in the community, I think I can help with that. You know, I think probably an age thing for me that, you know, I was 16 when I started on the railway. Now, 40 years hence, I'm sort of thinking, well, how can I help young people? And I don't just think of railway young people. How can I help young people be well? Because I think the pressures that are on young people across the spectrum in all sorts of walks of life in this country are significant. So I think, well, if there's anything I can do to help them, then I'd jolly well go and do it.
What advice would you give to railway workers who might be struggling with their mental health?
I think, you know, some of the things we've talked about already in this podcast is, you know, if you feel that you can maybe articulate how you feel on a piece of paper, first of all, and that's a really brave step that people can take. Of course, also, just as I experienced in 2020, once it's written down on a piece of paper, you know, actually, even if you just handed it to people, because you say, actually, I don't feel I've got the confidence to speak about it, but look, I've written some thoughts down. So I think some advice would be, you know, how are you feeling? Jot it down. If you can then search within your workplace, if there are sort of template documents that you can fill in, you know, like the one I cited about how to have a mental health conversation with your manager, or even if you've just jotted some thoughts down, that can help phrase a conversation with a family member or a friend, you know, go for a coffee or a tea. And you've got them jotted down in front of you, I think that's a good first step. I think the other things that I, and it's partly drawing on personal experience or experience where I've talked and supported people who aren't well, is if you're able to do that, it then becomes easier then to frame a conversation with a doctor. And doctors are fantastic people, and bless the National Health Service under tremendous strain, but they are very receptive to how we support people in this country with their mental health. A little vignette, you know, when I first rang and they sort of said, right, okay, we'll get an appointment in 2 weeks' time. I sort of found it upon myself. I said, no, actually, that's not acceptable. I need to speak to somebody in an hour, please. So I put the phone down, the phone rang again and they rang back. So the NHS, you know, have flags whereby they will, you know, if they recognise that people need help, they will go and help. And so your GP, great person to start with. I think the other thing, you know, where I would offer the benefit of experience is, although it can be difficult, is have a conversation. If, you know, if you're employed, go and have a conversation with your employer. You know, even if you start with perhaps a trusted friend or a colleague, and they then may come in with you to go and have a conversation as a support, then that's a worthwhile thing, because of course employers have a duty of care to people, you know, under the Health and Safety Work Act 1974. So that's another good area. I've just reminded myself, I think one of the lessons that I talk about in the talks that I give is, although it's a big ask, don't be afraid to have a conversation. Of all the people that I spoke and asked for help, nobody turned me down. And so that's in the railway industry, my friendship group.
Your family?
Yeah, and a family, goodness, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They were almost like, thank goodness, Dad, just come and talk to us now. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Come and do it. It's all good.
Yeah. And what do you think railway companies and railway employers could do better to help their employees in this regard?
There's been some good progress made so far with things like mental health first aiders, training managers to have a mental health conversation with their employees, but I still don't think it's enough. And I suppose I could see maybe a frustrated train operating company saying to me, well, what do you think is enough? I don't know the answer, but what good would look like if, you know, your absence levels are very low, because actually people are well, healthy, happy, and there's an environment whereby they can speak up and feel able to speak up. Because, of course, you know, that's, aside from being caring as an employer, that's good business for people if you've got a happy and healthy workforce. So I think the rail industry mustn't rest on its laurels. There's people like ourselves you know, who can share lived experience and help inform things like policies. There are, I suppose, you know, there are many ways to sort of come at this. So a combination of the right environment for people, there's policies and processes, there's people that are trained, then things start coming together, you know, in terms of providing good support for people and a good environment for people.
For you, what's next for Headshunt?
I ultimately would want to step away from it because I wouldn't want it to solely be associated with me. And so I think for me, what I'd like to see for Headshunt is that it flourishes as a registered charity, exists as a body, draws in other people, because I think, you know, I think I've learnt myself from personal experience, but also feedback given back to me is the power of people talking firsthand is not to be underestimated. So I'd like to, and I can help facilitate this, you know, encourage other people to speak. I've got a couple of the volunteers that want to do that now, and that they're going to come on some talks with me and help inspire them how to go and give talks. So I think for me would be, you know, if Headshunt continues, it hasn't got to be with me. I absolutely don't want that in many respects, but I'd like to see it sort of flourish. And if I can just help in any way, then great. And let some people take it on and expand it, because I know I haven't got all the answers. And I think, you know, for me, I think with a diversity of thought, diversity of people's experience, I think it can sort of still go on and do great things.
And how can people get in touch with you at Headshunt?
So the first step is we've got a website, headshunt.com, but also the other area is through Twitter. It is through my Twitter page at PGS Rail. We actually need some help, and so we would look for a volunteer to help us develop our website so it sort of ticks well. But generally, come and give a talk, we'd happily do, or offer their services and volunteer from the query form that'll come through to us.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
No, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And, everyone's very grateful for everyone you've helped so far, and hopefully help many more people in the future.
Yeah, we're up for it, so we'll just keep going. Thank you.
Thanks very much.